Hello and welcome to another episode of the NBCSports.com College Basketball Talk Podcast. It is Friday, December 7th. My name is Rob Doster. I have a good show on the way for you today. I was able to catch up with my buddy from CBS Sports, Gary Parrish, and we spent a good 30 minutes talking about the Shaka Smart tenure at Texas. Shaka is a fascinating individual to me and a fascinating coach. He has not gotten Texas going the way that he expected to when he took the job, but he still has managed to put six of his former assistants into Division I head coaching jobs, including two during the last coaching carousel in the spring, and I wanted to know why. I wrote a big story on it that you can read up on NBCSports.com right now, and I know that Parrish has a very good relationship with Shaka and has written about Shaka as well. So I think it'll be an enlightening conversation. It's an interesting conversation, and it's one that we can kind of dive into. Before we get into that, I need to tell you guys about StockX. Ever wonder how to get the hottest new sneakers, the ones that barely hit shelves? Don't have the time to camp out for 3 days to get your hands on some Yeezys? The answer to your problems is here, and it is StockX, a revolutionary new marketplace for buying and selling 100% authentic sneakers, as well as streetwear, watches, handbags, whatever you're in the market for. Millions are already using StockX to find everything after it sells out, from the latest Yeezys to every retro Jordan on the planet to the hottest new streetwear from brands like Supreme, Bape, Palace. There's even a marketplace to buy and sell pre-owned, excellent condition handbags and watches from high-end brands like Louis Vuitton, Gucci, Rolex, Tudor. They're all there. So how does it work? It's simple. It's like buying and selling stock. Buyers set their bidding price, sellers set their asking price, and when those prices match, the deal is made. The site includes real-time market data for you to use, allowing you to see how much an item has sold for in the past, how much it's selling for now, where the best deals can be had. It includes breakdowns by size. You can see weekly highs and lows. You can see quarterly averages. Savvy buyers are going to be able to find deals. And here's the best part. You don't need $1,000 to get a pair of shoes that you like, even a trendy pair. This is what I did. I'm not what you would call a sneakerhead, but I know what I like. I'm an Air Max guy. So I went to StockX.com/collegebb and I found the pair that I loved. The colors matched a few different outfits. I was able to wear the shoes, you know, more than one day a week. They're perfect. So I put in a lowball bid, $50 less than what the asking price was. And 2 weeks later, I got the confirmation email that said the deal had been made. I got my sneakers at the price that I wanted to spend. If you're not a bargain hunter like I am, then you can just meet the seller's price and the shoes will be shipped your way. Most importantly, StockX is the middleman that ensures total anonymity between the buyer and the seller. They have a team of experts that verify every item is 100% authentic. Don't get burned by fakes ever again and do as I did. Go to StockX.com/collegebb and get your sneaker fix. That's StockX.com/collegebb. StockX. Now you know. And now let me welcome on Gary Parrish of CBS Sports. It took months and months of me begging and pleading Parrish to come on the podcast, and finally I was able to convince him to come on. So GP, I just want you to know, man, I'm honored and I'm touched and I'm blessed to be graced by your presence today.
It's my pleasure to be here. I'm sorry that it's taken so long to arrange this. You really do when you text me. I always feel bad because you text at like the worst possible time. One time it was like, I've got to go check my son out to take him to the dentist. Another time I'm about to start writing the Politex column. And so I've had to politely decline many times, but I promised you we'd make it happen. And here we are. Look at us. Here we are after all these days.
I know that you have three kids and I know that two of them are under the age of four. And I know that you have like seven different jobs, but I really should be like the priority in your life and in your existence. So if moving forward, as long as we can just like kind of make that clear that I need to be number one in your life, then I think that this relationship will be a lot better.
You know, it's interesting. I was getting ready to have that conversation with my wife anyway about how I think Rob should be the number one priority in my life. And then after that, in some order, her and our three children, and then my three jobs. So I'm glad you're pushing me to go ahead and have that conversation. I've been putting it off for a little while, but perhaps this weekend she and I will get to it and finally have, you know, sometimes you have to have tough conversations in a marriage. This is going to be one of them.
All right, man. So
part of the reason that I have you on here is I wrote something long and kind of in depth about Shaka Smart today. And I know that you know that program. I know that you know Shaka. I know that back in the day, I think you were one of the first people to really write about what he was doing at VCU. I remember there you had a couple stories about him and the relationship that he had with his players. And the consensus that I kind of came to, and I'll, if you'll give me like a minute or two to kind of work through this, is that so Shaka has six Division I head coaches in his coaching tree, which is one less than Mike Krzyzewski. It's one less than Thad Matta. It is the same number as Bill Self. It's one more than Tom Izzo. It's two more than Jay Wright. And he's 41 years old. He's been doing this for 10 years. But he's never won a regular season conference title. He hasn't won an NCAA tournament game since 2013. He hasn't been out of the first weekend since he made that Final Four run in 2011. And I tried to set out to figure out why that was the case, why so many people are kind of flocking to his staff. So many ADs are flocking to his staff. So he just had two guys hired this fall. One of them hadn't been on his staff since 2015, but the other was Mike Morrell, who had been with him as long as anybody since 2012. And I'm just kind of curious, you know, I know that you cover this stuff, you follow this stuff. Why do you think that coaches or that athletic directors have been going to him and going to his staff and going to VCU assistant coaches to try to build up their program? And why do you think they're doing so, even though he's not necessarily building things up at Texas the way that people maybe thought that he would when he got hired?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of this is that I believe two of his so-called the members of his so-called coaching tree are guys that got hired at VCU after him. So two of these guys became head coaches. Well, I guess Will was a head coach before he went back to VCU.
Yeah, and Rhodes was at Rice. Three of the four guys that have been head coaches before Morrell right. and Jeremy Ballard got hired, three of the four guys that were already head coaches have moved on to other jobs. They've had that much success. Like that's the craziest thing about this to me is not only does he have the successful Division I head coaches in his tree, they're successful. Will Wade's on his third job since leaving VCU. Mike Rhodes is on his second job. Jamie and Christian took Mount St. Mary's to two NCAA tournaments and is on to his second job. Mike Jones has been at Radford for 8 years. He just made the NCAA tournament last season, and now he's won at Notre Dame and at Texas this week. And it's just it's hard for me to wrap my head around watching the Wonder Kid, right, kind of struggle to get things going at Texas while everybody in his coaching tree is having the same kind of success that he had when he was at VCU. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no. I think, you know, one of the things that makes Shaka different than, I don't want to say all head coaches, but certainly some head coaches, is he hires a particular type of person to be on his staff. I've had guys that I know in the industry who have reached out to me before because they know I know Shaka. Our relationship goes way back. I knew Shaka when he was an assistant for Oliver Purnell at Clemson. You know, that's when I first met him. I spent time with Shaka and his wife. You know, Shaka's, you know, when he's come to, you know, Memphis to recruit, you know, he's spent time with my family. He and I go back a long ways, and we've spent a lot of time together. And there's some guys who know that I know him, and they'd reach out to me over the years and be like, hey, Shaka's got a spot open on his staff. You know, I don't know if you could, you know, connect this, maybe put in a word for me. And I have had to tell guys sometimes, and it's always an awkward thing, but it's you say it in the nicest way possible. Like, listen, I think the world of you, and I think that you'd be great, but you don't really fit what he usually hires. And my point being this, I think he hires really impressive, smart guys who probably interview well. And so when you are an athletic director and you get one of these quote unquote Shaka smart guys into the room with you, it usually resonates with you. I think across the board, the guys you've named, they're all pretty. I mean, would you agree, though, the one to the extent that you know these guys, like they're all pretty impressive guys. They're obviously sharp guys. And I'm not actually surprised that A, they've been able to get head coaching jobs, but also that they've been largely successful. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And I think that it's a credit to the effort that he puts in kind of figuring out who the good coaches are and not necessarily who the guys that come with the hype are, right? Like, so Mike Rhodes, when he got hired at VCU, he had just spent 10 years as a head coach at a Division III program. And it's not often that you see a guy get a job at a Division I school and go out and hire a guy that spent 10 years as a head coach at a Division III program after playing Division III basketball, right? When Mike Jones got the Radford job and he had a spot open on the staff that was right after they made the Final Four, he could have gotten anybody, right? You're a Final Four coach. You're a guy that everybody has marked down as like one of the next, hot commodities, next stars in the coaching industry. He could have probably hired anybody he wanted to. And he went down to William & Mary and hired Jamian when Jamian was a guy that had been a Division I coach for 2 years after starting in the Division III ranks, right? So Mike Morrell
was... you've ever been around Jamian, you know he is a super impressive guy.
Yes. And so he's, Mike Morrell was an NAIA player, right? It's not necessarily a guy that was one of these like hot shot up and coming assistants that he's going out and hiring. So he's going out and finding guys at maybe necessarily a different level that are guys that he identifies as people like him. I think that's the best way to phrase it, right? And one of the things that, I talked with all of these guys to write the story, and one of the things that really stood out to me, and part of the reason I think that he's struggling to get Texas going a little bit, is everything that he does is built on like building relationships with people and building relationships on the players in his program and building relationships with his staff members. Like, that's the thing that he prioritizes more than anything else when he's hiring people, is the ability to build relationships with people. And I think that when you look at what he did at VCU, he found guys that maybe had a little bit of a chip on his shoulder that could connect with him, that he could connect with, and that he could kind of get to play that Havoc style and that aggressive style, and that would run through a wall for him because they knew that Shaka would run through a wall for them if he had to. Does that make sense? And now that he's at Texas, I mean, look, he's had some bad luck, right? Isaiah Taylor ended up going pro the year that they expected him to be the senior point guard and the leader for a team that had a bunch of young freshmen, right? Andrew Jones, it's silly to think about it in basketball terms because he's battling leukemia, but he was the guy that was supposed to be the star point guard on the team. And when you lose that for a second straight year, it's tough for you to overcome. But it's also a situation where he's got to go out and recruit 4 and 5 star guys that are going to end up being there for 1 year or 2 years. And it's different coaching those guys than it is coaching someone like a Briante Weber or a Trevion Graham or some of the best players that he had when he was at VCU. Do you think that's fair?
Of course. And that's always a challenge, or I shouldn't say always, but it's sometimes a challenge for coaches who go from a certain level of the sport to the top level of the sport, because you are suddenly recruiting and coaching players who have been brought up a different way. Like the guys he flourished with at VCU were all largely off the radar, not 5-star, not McDonald's All-American, not future lottery pick guys. And so you get them to buy in, subscribe to a certain culture, subscribe to a certain philosophy, and he really was tremendous there. It's why he got offered basically every job that opened from 2011 until he took the Texas job. I know that it is true that he hasn't been back to the second weekend of the NCAA tournament since he went to the Final Four in 2011, and that's undeniably a ding on his resume. I think even Shaka would acknowledge that. But, he did at VCU end up going to 5 straight NCAA tournaments. Like, after he made that Final Four, he never missed the NCAA tournament again. And I know that it didn't result in the types of finishes that perhaps some VCU fans wanted, but I will say, at a place like VCU, and I mean this with all due respect, you should never get to a point where you just think NCAA tournament appearances are birthrights, where you think NCAA tournament appearances is just what you ought to do at a bare minimum. Give me my Sweet 16s and Elite 8s, because you'll be reminded very quickly that that's just not the case. And so there, one way to look at Shaka's, you know, career is to point out that since the Final Four, he's never been back to the second weekend of the tournament. I would just point out that in his career, in the past 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 seasons, he has been to 7 NCAA tournaments in 8 seasons. That's not easy to do.
Yeah, and I think that is something. It's a point that needs to be made. And the other part of it is he did all that while taking VCU from the CAA to the Atlantic 10.
That's not easy to do either.
Yes, when you look at some of these other mid-major programs that have gone up in level, they don't all have the same amount of. Look at George Mason. What has George Mason done in the Atlantic 10 since they got there, right? And I know that they went through the coaching change. They don't have Jim Larrañaga anymore and all that stuff. But it's still – Shaka made VCU a top 25 program in the CAA. They go up a level. They're still a top 25 program in the Atlantic 10, which was objectively a much, much more difficult conference. And I don't think that that should be overlooked. I also think that – and tell me if you think I'm being unfair here, but I don't know if a program like Texas, with the way that the one-and-done culture is kind of going in college basketball, is necessarily the right spot. Because I think that he is a guy – so John Beilein, right, kind of knows what he is. He's the best offensive coach or one of the best offensive coaches in college basketball. The reason that he has Michigan going the way that it's going right now is because he saw – where his leak was, and he went out and he hired Luke Jakelic, and all of a sudden now they're one of the best defensive teams in college basketball, and all he has to do is worry about how to make Xavier Simpson like a good point guard, right? All he has to worry about is that. Whereas with what Shaka is doing, I think he is better than any other coach in college basketball, getting guys to buy in and play for him and building those relationships and becoming – everyone talks about how they want their basketball program to be a family and a family atmosphere and all that stuff. And I think he's better than anybody at doing that. I just think that he needs, where he is right now, either someone to come in and help him with, you know, maybe running the offense or something. I don't necessarily know exactly what it is, but I feel like there's something that's missing there, especially when you consider the fact that he's at a place where he's not going to be able to get 3 and 4 years with his guys.
Right. Listen, I don't think there's many coaches in America who couldn't use some quote unquote help in some way. Right.
Right. Right.
And if John Beilein is willing to admit that he could, then everybody should be able to admit that they could. And to your point about the offense, you know, in Shaka's first year, they were 49th in offensive efficiency. In his second year, they were 177th in offensive efficiency. Last year, 89th in offensive efficiency. Right now, 99th in offensive efficiency. There's an issue there, undeniably. You should not have the level of player that he's consistently had and be that inefficient on the offensive end of the court. And so if you want to say that perhaps a hire to help in that regard is a reasonable thing to consider, I don't see how anybody could argue against that. I will say you touched on something that I think is interesting, and it's just about the bad luck. He's had tremendously bad luck since he became Texas head coach. Now, this is not to make an excuse for Shaka. Shaka doesn't need me to make excuses for him. But I do think sometimes explanations are confused with excuses. It's not making an excuse, but it is trying to explain what has happened there. And so you mentioned that after his first season, and he goes to the NCAA tournament that first season, he loses Isaiah Taylor, who I don't believe was drafted, who could have reasonably come back to school, who could have, should have. I mean, I'm way past the point of telling young people what they ought to do, stay or go. I think everybody ought to do whatever they think's best for them, as long as they understand what's realistic and what isn't. Like if you're an Isaiah Taylor and you're leaving Texas because you think you're going to be a top 10 pick, well, now you're being dumb. But if you're leaving Texas just because you're ready to be done with college basketball and get a paycheck in whatever form, in whatever country, well, then that's fine with me. Go do it. It's fine with me. So I'm past the point of telling people what they should or shouldn't do. But, you know, there was not millions out there to be made playing basketball, and he still leaves. He still leaves Texas early.
One quick thing, if you don't think that hurt Texas, Isaiah Taylor is in the NBA right now. I didn't know this until I actually looked it up, but he played a very nice 69 games for the Atlanta Hawks last season.
Very nice. And you know the truth, I did not know that until this morning as well when I looked it up, because we touched on Texas on our CBS Sports Ion College Basketball podcast, not as extensively as this, but I did go, oh wow, Isaiah Taylor played 69 games in the NBA last season. Nice. So
so both make the same juvenile jokes. All right.
Right. So okay. So then you go to year two. You know, Tevin Mack was the leading scorer, whatever you think of him. And he lost. Shaka suspended him, you know, after 15 games, and he never played again for Texas. All right. And then last year was year three, and his leading scorer after 10 games is diagnosed with leukemia. So Shaka Smart has been the head coach of Texas for three seasons, and in two of those three seasons, he has lost his leading scorer smack dab in the middle of the season. Like, that's not easy to overcome. Again, not an excuse, but it is an explanation to some degree, I think.
Yeah, and I don't think that it should go overlooked that a team that is having struggles on the offensive end of the floor is doing it while they are playing without the guy that was expected to be their starting point guard, right? When his first season there, when he had Isaiah Taylor, they were top 50 nationally in offensive efficiency, which isn't great, but it's good enough, right? It's good enough to get you to a six seed. It's good enough to get you to the NCAA tournament. The following season, they have to play Andrew Jones at the point guard as a freshman, which, you know, he's not even necessarily a natural point guard. And now you're asking him to do something maybe he's not the best at while doing it as a freshman in a role that he wasn't necessarily maybe expecting to play. Then the year after that, when Andrew Jones is supposed to come back and be the starting point guard as a sophomore, you know, he's dealing with leukemia. And look, that basketball is secondary to him getting healthy and figuring that thing out and beating it. But I it's worth mentioning that Shaka Smart went in there thinking he was going to have this kid playing the point for him, and now he's in a situation where Matt Coleman is a guy starting for him as a freshman once again. And I mean, look, freshman because starting at the point is not ideal.
Because Andrew Jones is not, and perhaps he just shouldn't be, right? Like, and who cares? Like, he's alive and healthy, so God bless him. But he's not the same player right now. So that's an issue.
Yes, it's an issue, and I don't think that should be overlooked. So luck has certainly played a role in it. And that's part of the reason why I'm not yet ready to say like, oh, that, you know, the Shaka Smart era at Texas is a disaster and it needs to end. But I think that even he would admit it if he was on this podcast right now, it's not necessarily going the way you envisioned. And you know what's probably the most frustrating part for him? Like literally exactly 2 weeks ago, Texas was coming off of a win over North Carolina where Curran Roach looked like he was going to end up being a lottery pick. And it was last two Fridays ago, the day after Thanksgiving, they opened up a 25-6 lead on Michigan State. And then all of a sudden, I remember seeing that score. I was sitting in the press room in the Barclays Center before Kansas played Tennessee. And I'm looking at the score on my phone and I'm like, oh, wow, you know what? Maybe the Shaka Smart's got this thing figured out. Maybe Curran Roach is actually awesome. Maybe Texas is going to be good this year. And then the next time I checked the score, they were down by 9 with like 2 minutes left in the second half. And, you know, then they went and they lost at home to Radford. And then they went and lost at home to VCU. And now all of a sudden we're having this conversation. And it's just, I can't imagine that's got to be frustrating.
I will say I would be more concerned about the state of the Texas program if recruiting wasn't going well. Because remember, Rick Barnes did not get fired at Texas because he wasn't winning. He went to the NCAA tournament even in his last year at Texas. It was because he was no longer recruiting at the level at which Texas is supposed to be recruiting. And on that note, Shaka Smart has enrolled three straight top 10 recruiting classes, 2016 top 10, 2017 top 10, 2018 top 10. And in 2019, right now, he's got a top 15 class, and they're still involved with at least one five-star player. So if he weren't recruiting, I would be like, okay, what's like, maybe this thing's not going to work. But I just tend to believe that when you're at a place like Texas and you consistently stack top 10, top 15 recruiting classes on top of each other, it's going to work out for you eventually. Again, in year two, he loses his leading score after 10 games. I mean, after 15 games. In year three, he loses his leading score after 10 games. That is incredibly bad luck. But, you know, he's enrolling high-level prospects. And if he continues to do that, you're going to look up. And I don't know if it's going to be this year, but you're going to look up eventually, and Texas is going to be on everybody's short list to be a Final Four type team, a national championship type team. And perhaps this is just where you and I might be a little different here, but I'm not concerned about the direction of the Texas program at all. I will chalk up what has happened to date. And by the way, what's happened to date is two NCAA tournaments in 3 years. That's not terrible. There are programs out there that would kill to have that. But I would chalk up, to the extent that it's been a little bit less than what some might want, I think losing your leading scorer after 15 games in year two and losing your leading scorer after 10 games in year three, that's tough for almost anybody to overcome.
Yeah, I think the way that I would phrase it is that I am a little bit concerned, but that I understand why it's gone the way that it's gone, right? Like I think you said it best when you say you don't want to give him an excuse, but when you can give a reason for why these things are happening, that's not the same as giving an excuse for why those things are happening. So it's understandable why he is where he is right now. And, you know, like I said, 2 weeks ago, we were having a very different conversation about what North Carolina was going, or I'm sorry, what Texas was going to end up being this season. The one other note that I do want to make is that, like, so you probably know Shaka better than I do, but every conversation I've had with him and every conversation I've had about him gives me the sense that, like, he just is this public perception that he has as one of, like, the really the best dudes in college basketball. Like, that's pretty fair, right? That's pretty accurate.
I think so. I mean, I like him a lot. I think he's really he's just smart. You know, he's not just a basketball coach. This is some guys that we write about and talk about, they're just basketball coaches. Like, there's not a whole lot more to them. You know, if they didn't just coach basketball, I don't know what they'd be doing. Shaka would be successful in any walk of life. You could tell him, hey, coaching's over and you're not allowed to ever coach again. Go find something else. And he would find something else, and he would be very successful at that thing. His wife is brilliant, just super smart woman. And so it's like, I'm a fan of that family. I'm a fan of that couple. And so to me, when people ask me about Shaka, my mind doesn't even go to basketball first. Like, I just think he's a super impressive guy, a smart guy, a thoughtful guy, a guy who's got interest outside of basketball, who obviously takes his job very seriously. But you can sit down and talk to Shaka about world events, about you don't have to talk about basketball with Shaka Smart for Shaka Smart to be very comfortable in the conversation. And I tend to be attracted to those types of people. You know, I'd like to consider myself somebody I get hit with all the time, stick to sports, right? Well, I don't want to. I have plenty of interest that have nothing to do with college basketball, nothing to do with any sport whatsoever. And I think Shaka is the same way. So I think he's a smart, thoughtful guy, but yeah, also just a good dude. There's a reason he has a great reputation within the sport, and it's because he's a smart, thoughtful, genuinely good dude.
Yeah, and we both have sons, and I don't know how you would feel about this, but I would feel very good about my son playing for a Shaka Smart program. Like, one of the things that stood out in reporting the story out is all the guys that worked for him. Like, the story, when I would ask for, like, stories about Shaka, like, it wasn't stuff about what he did during a game or an adjustment that he made or anything like that. It was, Jamie and Christian, the first time that he walked into one of the practices after getting the job, is Shaka Smart is, you know, it's an hour after practice, like 9 o'clock at night, and Shaka Smart is just sitting there on the court in the center circle talking to Darius Theus about life. You know, it was Mike Rhodes saying that one of the core principles of that program is they just call it spending time. And what he wants you to do is spend time with the players, get to know the players. And if you help develop them as people, then they're going to get better as basketball players as a result. And those are the things I think that kind of stand out about him, at least in talking to people that have been around him. And I mean, look, if you talk to any of the guys that have worked with him, like, they'll go to war for him. You know, they are as loyal to him as I think you'll find any assistants are to the guys that hired them and that they worked for.
Well, every coach in a press conference somewhere talks about, you know, his job being more than just coaching basketball. His job is to turn boys into men, or prepare these young people for life after basketball. Not all of them actually subscribe to that. They all say it. Not all of them really care. A lot of them are just trying to make as much money as they can and win as many games as they can. They care very little about the other stuff, or at least they don't prioritize the other stuff. And perhaps I shouldn't say lots, but certainly some. I think Shaka takes that responsibility seriously. You know, he, and I've written about this before, and I've had several conversations with him about it. You know, he grew up without his father. You know, his father just left one day, and it had a real impact on his life in a way that I can't quite understand because my father never did that to me, but in a way that many of his players can't understand because I know at VCU, at least, a lot of his players grew up without fathers. And so he did feel some responsibility to be more than just a basketball coach. It does feel a responsibility to be more than a basketball coach because his father figures – his main thought became was his college basketball coach. And so he needed somebody to be that for him. And so he understands better than most why his players might need him to be that for them. And it is also one of the reasons, and I know he eventually left and he was always going to eventually leave, but it's among the reasons he stayed at VCU for as long as he did. You know, I wrote a story about it. You could probably Google and find it. In that story, I was careful to say none of this means he's staying at VCU forever because I knew he was probably leaving, you know, after that season if one of these big jobs like Texas open. But he told me that, okay, so not only did his father leave him when he was a kid, but then he went off to college and his college coach became his father figure. And then his college coach left for another job. And he was just experiencing this abandonment. Now twice in his life, like the two men in his life that he looked up to and loved both walked out of it in very different ways. One in a way that's shameful, the other in a way that's just a career move that is understandable. But it had a real impact on him. And, you know, I always knew he was going to have a hard time walking away because he knew what that felt like. Ultimately, you have to do it when something like Texas opens and you're the coach at VCU. But I know that was a real thing for him, and I know that he still cares deeply about trying to be more than just a basketball coach because when he was a player, he needed his basketball coach to be more than just a basketball coach.
All right. Can we move on to the games this weekend? Because I know that you are just as good at losing money gambling as I am, so I figured that what better way to get the weekend ready to go than to talk about the ways that we can lose money. You up for it?
I am very good at picking the wrong team. Yes.
All right, so fade Parrish, and the problem is going to be
– you really would be better off just doing that. It's wild, and I'm sure you run into this as well. Your friends assume because you cover this sport and you know – I can talk extensively about, you know, Gonzaga, Tennessee, or Nevada, Arizona State, and yet then you'll get to a point where you say, okay, who you pick? And I'll pick somebody, and it just won't go that way. Like you don't have – this is what I always say because we get asked on television all the time to pick games. And my point is you don't have to be right when you're predicting a game. You just have to sound right. If you can sound right in the moment, that's good enough for television for the moment. And then the game goes however it goes. If it was easy to pick games, everybody would do it.
Yeah. The issue I have is I think about it too much. And I kind of – and then I end up – talking myself into circles, and you know, I'm like you. I have a text chain of buddies that like to wager on sporting events, and there have been two times this season where I've said, okay, look, this is a bet that's gonna hit. I'm like 75% confident in it. If you want to bet on something, bet on this game. And both times they have ended up being losers. And so we need to turn this train around. We need to turn this franchise around, GP. And what better way than this weekend? So let's start with Nevada, Arizona. Nevada is favored by 6. The total is 162. What do you like there?
I would take Nevada, if only because Nevada so far this season is exactly what it's supposed to be. An overwhelming, Final Four caliber team. I don't know if you caught what I wrote about it. It's very brief, but sort of in passing with Matt Norlander on the Ion College Basketball Podcast last Sunday night, I said that this Nevada team reminded me a lot of the 2008 Memphis team. And what I meant by that is that
– of course you compared them to Memphis.
Well, like, why? Well, listen to
the comparison. Do they have the same KenPom rankings? Is that what it is?
No, just listen to it, how it lines up. Former NBA coach in charge builds a power outside of the normal power structure. You know, wins his league by multiple times. Wins his outmanned league by multiple games last season. Goes to the second weekend of the NCAA tournament. Then brings back three of the top four scorers from that team. It's the Martin twins and Jordan Caroline. And then adds a five-star freshman, Jordan Brown. And is now expected to just overwhelm everybody in its league, same way Memphis did to CUSA back in 2007, 2008. I'm not pretending that Jordan Brown is Derrick Rose. And I don't even think this Nevada team is as good as that Memphis team. But it really does line up similarly. You know, they were both built in unconventional ways. Memphis took a bunch of prep school kids, really like placed them in a prep school, then took them out of the prep school. You know, Nevada's a bunch of transfers, you know, former NBA coach, you know, bring back important pieces from a team that was wildly successful and then add a five-star freshman to the mix and now go run through your league. That Memphis team started 26-0. I won't be surprised if this Nevada team also starts something like 26-0. So my point is Nevada is exactly what Nevada is supposed to be. Awesome and overwhelming for everybody so far this season, including at Loyola, Maryland. I mean, at Loyola, Chicago last week and at USC last week. Whereas Arizona State's a little bit of a surprise, a little bit of an overachiever. And, you know, KenPom's got it as a 10-point spread. And so anytime there's that big of a discrepancy, I'm just going to lay the points.
Yeah, that's the inefficiency that you need to capitalize on is when you see a 4-point difference in a line between KenPom and what Vegas is offering. I'm with you there. I don't know if I fully buy into the Arizona State bandwagon yet. That game is going to be at midnight Eastern time.
Yeah, I'm sleeping through it anyway. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, I'm gonna.
I can't stay awake that late. That's crazy.
I'm gonna get the DVR is gonna get a workout because my son's gonna be up at 6 o'clock, no matter what on Saturday morning. So I'll just watch it then. Kentucky, Seton Hall, we don't have an official line on this game yet, so I'm just going to give you what the KenPom spread says. KenPom has Kentucky as a 7-point favorite with a total of 149.
I'd probably take the points. I mean, this is the first non-home game since Kentucky opened the season in Indianapolis, got blasted by Duke. So it's not only the first non-home game since then, in basically a month, but it's a game against the best opponent they've played since they played Duke. And it's not like, you know, Kentucky hasn't lost again since the Duke game, but that's got more to do with them just playing completely outclassed teams inside Rupp Arena. So now suddenly you're in New York City against Seton Hall. It's not a road game. Kentucky will have more people at Madison Square Garden than Seton Hall. But still, outside of Rupp Arena for the first time in a month, and playing the best team you've played in a month. I'm not predicting a Seton Hall upset, but I would probably take those points, sure.
Yeah, I'm not convinced that Kentucky has solved all of the issues that they had earlier in the season. If you had to bet your house on one of three teams winning the SEC, either Tennessee, Auburn, or Kentucky, as of today, who you got?
Tennessee. I just think they're safe. They're reliable. They're not going to beat themselves. They know exactly who they are. They don't have NBA prospects, probably, but they've got really good college players. Grant Williams is awesome. Admiral Schofield is improved. You know, they got a bunch of those pieces back, almost all those pieces back from last season's team that shared the SEC title. I think they're the safest pick. They probably don't have the highest ceiling, but they're probably the safest pick.
While we are on that subject, we have Gonzaga against Tennessee is that in Phoenix? Yeah, that's in Phoenix on Sunday. The line, according to KenPom, is Gonzaga by 3, and the total is 159. What do you like there, GP?
I take the points, if only because I think it's a total coin flip game. Whichever team you made the underdog, I would just say I'll take points in this one because I would assume that in the under 4 – we're either going to be in a one possession game or we will eventually get to a one possession game. I think this is going to look a lot like Kansas, Tennessee, in the sense that, you know, in the final minutes, either team was a shot away or a stop away from winning the game. I think this one will go the same way. You know, and don't ever forget, though Gonzaga has been awesome, they are playing without their leading returning scorer, Killian Tilly, and they've been pushed to the final minute by both Washington and Illinois. So it's not like everybody remembers Gonzaga beat Duke, and you should. It was an awesome win. I was courtside in Maui. It was a beautiful place to spend Thanksgiving. But it's not like Gonzaga has just been crushing everybody. In Maui, Illinois could have beaten them in the final minute. And the other night, Washington could have beaten them in the final minute. So I'll just take the points and won't be surprised if Tennessee wins.
All right, the last one I want to talk to you about is Wisconsin at Marquette. According to KenPom, that line is Wisconsin minus one, and the total is, I got to do some math here, 137.
I'm going to take the home team. Anytime, and I do think Wisconsin is better than Marquette, but Marquette has a real home court advantage there. And, you know, they've upset people in that building in recent years under Wojo. And I think Wisconsin's good. I had one Big Ten coach tell me that he thought Wisconsin was the best team in the league. I don't know if I agree with that, but I did have one Big Ten head coach tell me that.
Was it Greg Gard?
It was not Greg Gard who said it. It was not Greg Gard who said it. But, you know, I think Wisconsin's good. I don't know if I agree with that. I think Wisconsin's better than Marquette. But I'll take Marquette at home, and in a you know, you're basically making me, you basically got me in a pick'em situation, and I can get Marquette, Marcus Howard at home. I'll take Marquette.
I hate betting Marquette. I hate it because Marcus Howard can go off for like 50 on any given night, right? But he also, like, if he ends up having one of those nights where he scores like 17, 18 points, then I don't know how Marquette is going to win that game. So basically what you're betting on is whether or not Marcus Howard goes bonkers, right? And I hate betting on whether or not Marcus Howard is going to go bonkers because it feels like you're just guessing instead of actually having any idea.
Hey, I got news for you. You're always just guessing.
I know, but I like to pretend that I'm not, GP. I like to think that I'm not. But you know what? My DraftKings sportsbook account is saying that maybe I should just start guessing.
Yeah, if you could ever actually it's amazing how you just look up and you don't know why you can't pick games correctly. Like you know more about this than most people, and yet it just doesn't matter at the end of the day. It's baffling to me.
You know what it is? It's little things like, so one of the games that I did not bet correctly when I told all of my friends to bet it was Michigan at Northwestern. And if you watched how the game played out, Michigan like opened up a 15-point lead in the second half, right? And they were in total control of that game. And then all of a sudden, Xavier Simpson decided that he just wanted to start firing up every three-pointer that he saw. I don't know if you watched any of that game, but there was like a five-possession stretch in the second half where he literally missed five straight three-pointers because Northwestern just did not guard him and said, okay, if you want to shoot threes, go ahead. And then he got pulled and he didn't play the rest of the game. So all of a sudden now you're losing your starting point guard, you're losing your best defender, you're losing the head of the snake, and that's the team that I freaking bet on. So you can't predict weird things like that happening in a college basketball game, and I'm convinced that's why I lost. That wasn't my bad. I read that game right. It's just one of those freaky things that happens, and that's the things that I tell myself as I go and try to make another bet and end up losing it.
Hey, whatever you have to say to rationalize your behavior is fine with me. I do it in all aspects of my life as well.
All right, last thing I got for you, and I promise this is the last thing, is you did actually go to the Maui Invitational. I've never been there. It's a bucket list thing for me. Was it as awesome as it looks on TV?
It's awesome. It's a great trip. I had never gone before because I could never justify it from a cost perspective or a time perspective, because it ain't easy to get there, especially not from Memphis, Tennessee. You know, I had to fly Memphis to LAX, layover, LAX to Honolulu, layover, Honolulu to Maui. It took me in travel time, like from leave my hotel in Maui to walk in my front door, it was 20 hours of travel time. I think going there, it was like 18. Coming home, it was like 20. And so it takes a long time to get there. And when there are other good alternatives to that week, like, you know, the Bahamas is very easy to get to. It's quick, same time zone. Then you've also got, you know, so that's, you know, you've got Battle for Atlantis. So that's same time zone. Get there basically, for me, Memphis to Atlanta, Atlanta straight there. Then there's Orlando with the Advocare Invitational. There's the Wooden Legacy, which I think is still in Anaheim. I've been to Orlando many times, been to Anaheim many times. So I would always just say, you know what, I'll go, or there's stuff going on in New York. So I would always just say, I'll just go to one of these other places. But the truth is, you know, since we launched CBS Sports HQ earlier this calendar year, they really like the idea of having somebody at big events so that they can go to them, and it just – it looks big. It looks like, hey, we, you know, this is a serious thing. They sent somebody to the, you know, World Series, to the Super Bowl, to the NBA Finals, or in this case to the Maui Invitational. So they actually asked me if I would go, and I was like, oh, of course I'll go. And once you're there, I will tell you, if you can get past the, my God, it takes forever to get there, once you're there, it is awesome. I mean, the resorts are obviously beautiful. Maui is beautiful. You know, you've got the ocean, obviously, but also the mountains, which get talked about less. It's just whichever way you look, it's a really pretty view. And then it was like 78 degrees every day. You know, and, you know, if you want to go swimming or get in the ocean, you can. The championship game was like noon local time. So that last night there, you've got a night off. You know, the games start early out there, and they're over. So you've usually got your nights available to you. I thought it was a tremendous trip. I will go back. I promise you, I'll go back. The only thing I'll do differently next time is I'll take my family. I didn't this time for a variety of reasons, but you do feel like, God, you wish you had people there to enjoy it with you, because you had a beautiful resort in a beautiful part of this world. It was an awesome trip. I'm glad I went.
I told you my horror story about traveling with my family to Hawaii, right? Have I told you this?
I don't know that one, but I do. I also have horror stories with traveling with kids, and You took your little boy to Hawaii?
Yes, we did. My wife was there for a conference. It was like 2 weeks after the season ended last year. So I just figured, might as well just go. And like, it was going there great. He slept for like 7 hours on the plane. It was a little difficult with the time change, but he was a trooper. He dealt with it. He had fun. He went swimming. We had a great time. We were in Honolulu the whole time. Like, we went up to the pineapple orchards that they have there. And, you know, me and him climbed a mountain. It was great. It was a great trip. On the way back, we went from Honolulu all the way to Atlanta.
That's too much.
Well, and here's the thing. Like, it was the overnight flight. So we were like, he's going to sleep, because it would have been nighttime his time. He only slept like 2 hours on the flight. And, I mean, whatever. We just had him locked into his iPad. He was watching it. He was fine. Like, Daniel Tiger, the greatest thing, greatest show ever invented for children. He's just plowing through them. But as we're landing, like, with this fasten seatbelt sign on and the landing gear already down, out of nowhere, he just projectile vomits four times in 10 seconds. All over me, all over our stuff, all over my wife, all over himself. And he just starts sitting there screaming at the top of his lungs. And it was awful. Oh, yeah, that's right, because we talked about the old lady that yelled at me.
Yeah, no, I know that story. And yeah, it's just a nightmare. I would never put my kids on it. I didn't even want to be on Honolulu to Atlanta, because that was an option for me. But I tried to break it up. So I went, you know, Memphis LAX is like 5 hours, and then LAX to Honolulu is like six. So I broke it up. I didn't want to do Honolulu to Atlanta. That's like 10, I think. And so I don't want to be on the same flight for 10 hours. I can't imagine my kids on the same flight for 10 hours. But I will tell you, as somebody who travels a lot, but also travels with children sometimes, I am totally understanding of what parents are going through on flights. So anytime I'm on a flight and there is a baby screaming or a kid, like, you know, just wilding out, I never get mad or frustrated. If it happens to be happening near me, you know, I'll try to be as reassuring for the parent as I can. Like, hey, no, I understand. It's all good. Because there's nobody who feels worse about that than the parent. Nobody. I mean, I've been on one when my middle boy was a baby, and for whatever reason, he just screamed for a solid hour, just cried for a solid hour. And you know that it's bothering everybody else. You feel sick about it. Like you'd pay $1,000 just to stop it right now, but you can't. And so I understand other parents find themselves in that situation, you know, all the time as well. I don't know how I'd feel if a kid threw up on me, but if it's just screaming and hollering and crying, I can I'm just sympathetic with the parent. I remain as calm as I could possibly be.
Luckily, Chase did not throw up on anybody else. He saved it all for my lap and my pants and my backpack and everything that was in my backpack. And yeah, it was strawberry yogurt that he had just eaten. Ooh. So didn't smell too good. Didn't look too good. Color wasn't very great. Didn't match with my outfit. But, you know, we survived. And here we are. But GP, yeah. I've kept you here for long enough, man. This was after you recorded your own podcast and before you have to go do your radio show. So I'm going to let you give your vocal cords a little bit of a rest. Go drink some hot tea. And I appreciate the time, my man.
All right, brother. Anytime. I'll talk to you soon. Mm-hmm.